This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Some Choose Darkness by Charlie Donnelly, narrated by Nina Alvemar. I fear I am writing a requiem for myself. Mozart. The Rush, Chicago, August 9th, 1979. The noose tightened around his neck, and the oxygen deprivation spun his head into a splendid mix of euphoria and panic. He allowed the nylon to take the full weight of his body as he eased off the stool. Those who did not understand the rush would consider his pulley system barbaric, and no one but him fully knew its power. The rush was a sensation more formidable than any narcotic. There was no other vector of life that could provide an equal experience. Quite simply, it was all he lived for. As he lowered himself off the stool, the rope to which the nylon noose was tethered creaked with the strain of his body as it slithered through the grooved rim of the pulley while he sunk toward the floor. The rope curved over the winch, ran down to a second pulley, then back up and around the third and final crank to form an M. Attached to the other end of the rope was another strap of soft nylon, which was wrapped around his victim's neck. Every time he lowered himself from the safety of the stool, the nylon around his neck took her weight as she levitated like magic off the ground 6 feet in front of him. Her panic was finally gone. There was no more kicking or flailing. When she rose now, it was dreamlike. The rush saturated his soul, and the image of her floating in midair enraptured his mind. He took her weight as long as he could bear, bringing himself to the brink of unconsciousness and to the edge of ecstasy. He closed his eyes briefly. So tempting was the lure to continue toward the high, but he knew the dangers of allowing himself to wander too far down that lurid path. To travel too long on its trail would prevent return. Still, he couldn't resist. With the nylon tight around his throat, he focused his half-closed eyes on his victim hovering across from him. The noose tightened its grip, pinched his carotid, and formed spots in his vision. He let go momentarily, closing his eyes and giving in to the darkness. Just for a bit. Just for a second more. The Aftermath, Chicago, August 9th, 1979. When he came back to the present, he gasped for air, but none would come. In a panic, he searched with his foot for the edge of the stool until his toes found the flat wooden surface. He stepped onto it and relieved the pressure from his neck, taking huge swallows of air as his victim sunk to the floor in front of him. Her legs no longer supported her when she reached the concrete. Instead, she crumpled in a heap, the weight of her body pulling his end of the rope until the thick safety knot lodged on his side of the pulley, keeping the noose slack around his neck. He pulled the soft nylon over his head and allowed time for the redness to leave his skin. He knew he'd gone too far tonight. Despite the protective foam collar he wore, he'd have to find a way to hide the deep purple bruising on his neck. He needed to be more careful now than he'd ever been before. The public had started to catch on. Newspaper articles began to crop up. The authorities had put out warnings, and fear was rising above the warmth of summer. With the public's heightened awareness, he had begun to stalk more carefully, plan more deliberately, and cover his tracks more thoroughly. The bodies he could hide, he had found the perfect location. The rush was more difficult to contain, and he worried that the veil covering his secret life would be pulled away by his own inability to conceal the elation he carried in the days after his sessions. He would be smart to shut things down, lie low and wait for the panic to calm. But the rush was too much to ignore. His existence depended on it. Sitting on the stool, he turned his back to his victim. He took a moment to bring his emotions under control. When he was ready, he turned to the body to begin the cleanup in preparation for transport the next day. When he was finished, he locked the place up and climbed into his vehicle. The ride home did little to tame the residual effects of the rush. When he pulled to the front curb, he saw the lights of the house extinguished. It was a good thing tonight. His body was still trembling, and he could not have managed normal conversation. Inside, he dropped his clothes in the washing machine, took a quick shower, and climbed into bed. She stirred as he pulled the covers over himself. "What time is it?" she asked with her eyes closed, head sunk into the pillow. "Late." He kissed her cheek. "Go back to sleep." She slid her leg over his body and draped her arm across his chest. He lay on his back, staring up at the ceiling. It usually took hours for him to settle down after he returned. He closed his eyes and tried to control the adrenaline that coursed through his veins. His mind replayed the past few hours. He was never able to remember it all, not clearly and not so soon after. In the weeks ahead, the details would come back to him. But tonight, behind closed lids, his eyes fluttered in wild saccades as the memory center in his mind offered brief sparks of the evening. His victim's face, the terror in her eyes, the nylon noose at a sharp angle around her neck. The images and sounds swirled through his mind in a fast flurry, and as he further played out the fantasy, the sheet stirred next to him as she woke. She curled farther into his side. With the rush pounding in his veins, the flushing of endorphins through the dilated blood vessels audible in his ears, he allowed her to kiss his neck, then his shoulder. He permitted her hand to sink to the waist of his boxer shorts. The rush overtook him, and he rolled on top of her. He kept his eyes closed as she let out soft moans, which he blocked from his mind. He thought of his workspace, of the darkness, of the way he could lay himself bare when he was in that place. He took on an easy rhythm and focused on the woman he had brought there earlier in the night, the woman who had levitated like a ghost in front of him. The sweet scent of roses. The woman reached into the garden, pinched the clippers to the base of the rose, and severed its stem. She repeated the process until she had 6 long-stemmed red roses in her hand. She climbed the stairs to her back porch, placed the roses on the table, and sat down in the rocking chair. Staring out over the field, she watched the young girl approach, climb the stairs, and walk up to her. Her voice was high-pitched and innocent, the way all children's voices should be.
"Why do you always take roses from the garden?" the young girl asked.
"Because they're beautiful. And if they're left on the vine, they'll eventually wither and go to waste. If I prune them, I can put them to better use."
"Do you want me to tie them?" the girl asked.
She was 10 years old and the sweetest thing to ever come into the woman's life. From her apron, the woman removed a twist tie, handed it to the girl, and watched as she carefully picked up the roses. Avoiding the thorns, the girl wrapped the tie around the stems, twisting until it bound the bouquet in a tight bundle.
"What do you do with the flowers?" the girl asked.
The woman took the perfect bundle from her.
"Go inside and clean up for dinner."
"I see you pick them every day, and I tie them for you, but I never see the flowers again."
The woman smiled.
"We've got work to do after dinner. I'll let you do the painting tonight, if you think your hand is steady enough."
The woman hoped the bait was enough to veer the conversation. The girl smiled.
"You'll let me paint all by myself?"
"Yes, it's time you learn."
"I'll do a good job, I promise,"
she said, before running into the house. The woman waited just a moment until she heard dishes clinking inside as the girl set the dinner table. Then she stood from the rocker, carefully arranged the newly bundled roses, and walked down the porch steps and out across the field behind the house. The sun was setting, and the shadows of birch trees cut across her path. As she walked, she lifted the flowers to her nose and inhaled the sweet scent of roses. Part 1. The Thief. Chapter 1. Chicago, September 30th, 2019. The chest pains had started the year before. There was never a question about their source. They were stress-induced, and the doctors promised they would never kill him. Tonight's episode was particularly distressing, though, waking him from sleep with a cool chill of night sweats. He tried to suck for air, but it was like breathing through a cocktail straw. The harder he worked to inhale, the more distraught he became. He sat up in bed and fought the fear of suffocation. History told him the episode would pass. He reached for the bottle of aspirin he kept in the nightstand drawer and placed one, along with a nitroglycerin tablet, under his tongue. After 10 minutes, the muscles of his chest relaxed, and his lungs were able to expand. It was no coincidence that this most recent bout of angina coincided with the arrival of the parole board letter, which sat on his nightstand. He had spent time reading the letter before he fell asleep. Accompanying the letter was the judge's summons for a meeting. He grabbed the document now as he climbed from bed, his sweat-soaked shirt cold against his skin as he walked down the stairs and headed to his office. He twisted the combination lock on the safe under his desk and pulled open the door. Inside was a stack of old parole board letters, to which he added the latest. The first parole hearing correspondence had arrived a decade before. Twice a year, the board met with his client, denying him his freedom and explaining their decision in a properly worded essay that would stand up against appeals and protests. But last year, a different document arrived. It was a lengthy review by the board chairperson, who described in rich detail how impressed the board was with his client's progress over the years, and how his client was the very definition of rehabilitation. It was after reading the final sentence of that letter, which indicated the parole board's enthusiasm for their next review and the suggestion that great opportunities lay ahead for his client, when the chest pains had begun. This latest correspondence marked the arrival of a slow-moving train that carried as its freight pain and misery, secrets and lies. That proverbial train had always been just a speck on the horizon, never making progress. But now it was a full-barreling freighter, growing larger by the day, impossible to stop, despite his many efforts. Sitting behind his desk, he stared at the middle shelf of the safe. A file folder was stuffed fat with pages from his investigation, an exploration that, during times of sorrow and angst like tonight, he wished he'd never embarked upon. The ramifications of his findings, however, were so profound and life-altering that he knew he would be empty had he not. And the idea that his own lies and deceptions might soon crawl from the shadows under which they had rested for years was enough to cause his heart to, literally, ache. He wiped the layer of perspiration from his forehead and worked hard to fill his lungs with breath. His biggest fear was that his client would soon be free to continue the search. The investigation, which had been declared fruitless, would enjoy a resurgence once his client walked from prison. This, he knew, could not happen. Everything in his power must be done to prevent it. Alone in his study, he felt a new chill come upon his body as his saturated shirt pressed to his shoulders. He closed the safe and spun the dial. The chest pains returned. His lungs tightened, and he leaned back in his chair to fight again the panic of suffocation. It would pass. It always did. Chapter 2. Chicago, October 1st, 2019. Rory Moore inserted her contact lenses, rolled her eyes, and blinked to bring the world into focus. She despised the vision her Coke bottle glasses offered, a bowed and distorted world when compared to the crispness of her contacts. But she loved the shelter her thick-rimmed frames provided. So, a compromise. After her contact lenses settled, she slipped non-prescription glasses onto her face and hid behind the plastic casings like a warrior ducking behind a shield. To Rory, each day was a battle. They agreed to meet at the Harold Washington Library Center on State Street, and 30 minutes after Rory had dressed in her protective armor, thick-framed glasses, beanie hat pulled low, coat buttoned to her chin with the collar up, she climbed from her car and walked into the library. Initial meetings with clients always took place in public locations. Of course, most collectors had trouble with this arrangement because it meant hauling their precious trophies out into the daylight. But if they wanted Rory Moore and her restoration skills, they'd follow her rules. Today's meeting called for more attention than normal, since it had been arranged as a favor for Detective Ron Davidson, who was not only a trusted friend, but also her boss. Since this was her side job, or what others annoyingly called her hobby, some part of her was honored that Davidson had reached out. Not everyone understood the complicated personality of Rory Moore, but over the years, Ron Davidson had broken through to win her admiration. When he asked for a favor, Rory never gave it a second thought. As she walked through the library doors, Rory immediately recognized the Kestner doll that was housed in a long, thin box and resting in the arms of the man waiting in the lobby. The blink of an eye and a quick glance at the gentleman holding the box was all it took for Rory to run through her appraisal of him, her thoughts flashing like lightning through her mind. Mid-50s, wealthy, a professional of some sort, business, medicine, or law, cleanly shaven, polished shoes, sport coat, no tie. She quickly backtracked and rejected the initial thought of a doctor or lawyer. He was a small business owner, insurance, or similar. She took a deep breath, arranged her glasses squarely on her face, and walked up to him.
"Mr. Bird?"
"Yes," the man said.
"Rory?"
The man, a full 12 inches taller than Rory's 5'2 stature, looked down on her petite frame and waited for confirmation. Rory offered none.
"Let's see what you've got," she said,
pointing at the porcelain doll that was carefully packaged in the box, before walking into the main section of the library. Mr. Bird followed her to a table in the corner. The library was only scantly populated in the middle of the afternoon. Rory patted the table and Mr. Bird laid the box down.
"What's the issue?" Rory asked. "This is my daughter's Kestner doll. It was a gift for her 5th birthday and has been kept in pristine condition."
Rory leaned over the table to get a better look at the doll through the plastic window in the box. The porcelain face was badly split down the middle, the cracks starting somewhere beyond the doll's hairline, running through the left eye socket and down the cheek.
"I dropped it," Mr. Bird said. "I'm beside myself that I was so careless."
Rory nodded.
"Let me have a look."
He pushed the box toward her, and Rory carefully unlocked the latch and lifted the lid. She inspected the damaged doll like a surgeon's initial assessment of an anesthetized patient lying on the operating table.
"Cracked or shattered?" she asked.
Mr. Bird reached into his pocket and produced a Ziploc bag that contained small pieces of porcelain. Rory noticed his thyroid cartilage rise and fall as he swallowed hard to control his emotions.
"These were everything I could find. I dropped it on hard wood, so I think I located all the pieces."
Rory took the bag and analyzed the shards. She went back to the doll and gently ran her fingers over the fractured porcelain. The split was well opposed and should come together nicely. The restoration of the cheek and forehead could be made to look flawless. The eye socket was another issue. It would take all her skill to restore, and she'd likely need help from the one person who was better than Rory at restoring dolls. The shattered portion, Rory was sure, would be found on the back of the head. The repair there, too, would be challenging due to the hair and the small bits of porcelain she held in the Ziploc bag. She didn't want to remove the doll from the box until she was in her workshop, for fear that more porcelain might fall from the shattered area. She nodded slowly, keeping her gaze on the doll.
I can fix this.
Thank God,
Mr. Bird said.
2 weeks. A month, maybe.
As long as it takes.
I'll let you know the pricing after I get started.
I don't care what it costs, as long as you can fix it.
Rory nodded again. She placed the Ziploc bag containing the shattered pieces into the box, closed the lid, and relatched the lock.
I'll need a phone number where I can reach you, she said.
Mr. Bird fished a business card from his wallet and handed it to her. Rory glanced at it before sticking it into her pocket. Bird Insurance Group, Walter Bird, owner. Rory attempted to lift the box and leave when Mr. Bird put his hand on hers. A stranger's touch had never been well tolerated, and Rory was about to recoil when he spoke.
The doll belonged to my daughter, he said in a soft voice.
The past tense caught Rory's attention. It was meant to. Rory looked at the man's hand on her own and then met his eyes.
She died last year, Mr. Bird said.
Rory slowly sat down. A normal response might have been, I'm sorry for your loss, or I see why this doll means so much to you. But Rory Moore was anything but normal.
What happened to her?
Rory asked.
She was killed, Mr. Bird said,
taking his hand off Rory's and sitting down across from her.
Strangled, they think. Her body was left in Grant Park last January, half frozen by the time she was found.
Rory looked back at the Kestner doll resting in the box, the right eye shut peacefully, the left eye open and askew with a deep fissure running through the orbit. She understood what was happening, and knew why Detective Davidson had been so adamant that she take this meeting. It was a classic bait and switch that Davidson knew Rory would be helpless to resist.
They never found him? Rory asked.
Mr. Bird shook his head, dropping his gaze to his dead daughter's doll.
Never had so much as a lead. None of the detectives return my calls anymore. It feels like they've simply moved on.
Rory's presence in the library that morning proved Mr. Bird's statement false, since it was Ron Davidson who had convinced her to come. Mr. Bird brought his gaze back to her.
Listen, this is not a setup. I reached for Camille's doll the other day because I was badly missing my daughter and needed to hold something that reminded me of her. I dropped the goddamn thing and shattered it. I couldn't bring myself to tell my wife because I feel so guilty, and I know it would send her into a fit of depression. This doll was my daughter's favorite possession through her childhood. So please believe me that I want you to restore it. But Detective Davidson told me that your work as a forensic reconstructionist is heralded in the city of Chicago and beyond. I'm prepared to pay you anything it takes for you to reconstruct the crime and find the man who wrapped his hands around my daughter's neck and choked the life from her.
Mr. Bird's stare became too much for Rory to handle, penetrating the protective shield of her non-prescription glasses. She finally stood, lifted the Kestner doll box off the table and secured it under her arm. The doll will take a month, your daughter much longer. Let me make some calls, and I'll be in touch. Rory walked out of the library and into the fall morning. She felt it as soon as Camille Bird's father had used the past tense to describe his daughter, that subtle tingling in her mind, that nearly imperceptible but now ever-present whisper in her ears, a murmur her boss knew goddamn well she wouldn't be able to ignore.
You're a real son of a bitch, Ron, Rory said as she exited the library.
She had been on hiatus from her job as a forensic reconstructionist, a scheduled break she forced herself to take every so often to avoid burnout and depression. This most recent pause had been longer than any of her others and was starting to piss off her boss. As she walked along State Street and back to her car, with Camille Bird's shattered doll under her arm, Rory knew the vacation was over. Chapter 3. Chicago, October 2nd, 2019. Her phone buzzed for the fifth time that morning, which she again ignored. Rory stared at her reflection in the mirror as she pulled her dark brown hair back and tied it off. She was not a morning person, and on principle did not answer her phone before noon. Her boss knew this, so Rory felt no remorse for ignoring him.
"Who is incessantly calling you?" a voice asked from the bedroom.
"I'm meeting Davidson."
"I didn't know you decided to go back to work," the man said.
Rory walked from the bathroom and slipped her watch under her wrist.
"Am I going to see you tonight?" she asked. "Okay, we won't talk about it."
Rory came over and kissed him on the mouth. Lane Phillips had been her... what? Rory wasn't traditional enough to label him a boyfriend, and this far into her 30s, she thought the description sounded juvenile. She'd never considered marrying him, despite that they'd slept together for the better part of the last decade. But he was much more than her lover. He was the only man on this planet, aside from her father, who understood her. Lane was hers. That was the best Rory could do in her own mind, and they were both okay with that.
"I'll tell you about it when I have something to tell. Right now, I don't know what I'm getting myself into." "Fair enough," Lane said, sitting up in bed. "I've been asked to appear as an expert witness on a homicide trial. I'll be testifying in a couple of weeks, so I'm meeting with the DA today. Then I'm teaching until 9 tonight."
When Rory tried to back away, he grabbed her hips.
"Are you sure you won't give me any clues about what Davidson lured you back with?"
"Stop by tonight after your class, and I'll catch you up." Rory gave him another kiss, batted away his roaming hands, and walked out of the bedroom. A minute later, the front door opened and closed. Her phone rang two more times as she sat in morning traffic on the Kennedy Expressway. She exited on Ohio Street and snaked through the grid-patterned streets of Chicago. She pushed through the congestion until she reached Grant Park, circled the side streets for 15 minutes until she found a parking spot too small for even her tiny Honda. Somehow she managed a brave parallel parking maneuver, unsure if she'd be able to escape the twisting and turning and bumper kissing when it was time to leave. She walked through the tunnel that cut under Lakeshore Drive and along the picturesque path until she came to the cusp of the park. Grant Park was a magnificent piece of real estate that separated the high-rise buildings of the Loop from the lakefront. The park was always a popular destination with tourists, and this morning was no exception. Rory walked through the crowds until she spotted Ron Davidson sitting on a bench near Buckingham Fountain. Despite that her coat was already buttoned to her neck, she pulled it tight, lifted her collar, and pushed her glasses up the bridge of her nose. It was a mild October morning, and others around her wore shorts and sweatshirts, enjoying the lake breeze and bright sunshine. Rory was dressed for a brisk fall day. Gray coat secured top to bottom, collar up, gray jeans, and lace-up Madding Girl Elwazé combat boots, which she wore everywhere, including during the dog days of summer. As Rory approached the detective, she pulled her slouchy fleece beanie down on her forehead. The edge of the hat touched the top of her glasses. She felt protected. Without introduction, she sat down next to him.
"Well, Christ be the king, it's the lady in gray," Davidson said.
The two had worked enough cases together for Davidson to know all of Rory's quirks. She shook hands with no one, something Davidson had learned after a few attempts where his hand floated in the air while Rory averted her eyes. She hated meeting with department personnel other than Ron, and she had little tolerance for red tape. She had never accepted a deadline on a job, and worked strictly solo on her cases. She returned calls at her leisure, and sometimes not at all. She hated politics, and if anyone, from an alderman to the mayor, tried to pull Rory into the spotlight, she disappeared for weeks. If her skills as a forensic reconstructionist weren't so outstanding, Ron Davidson would never tolerate the headaches she caused.
"You've been off the grid, Gray."
Rory allowed the corners of her mouth to curl slightly while she stared at Buckingham Fountain. No one but Davidson called her Gray, and over the years Rory had warmed to the nickname, a combination of her attire and her detached outward persona. Busy with life.
"How's Lane?"
"Fine."
"Is he a better boss than me?"
"He's not my boss."
"Yeah, you spend all your time working for him."
"Working with him." Ron Davidson paused for a moment.
"You haven't returned a call for 6 months."
"I told you I was on hiatus."
"There were a few cases I could have used your help on."
"I was getting burned out. I needed a break." "Why do you think most of the detectives who work for you aren't worth a shit?"
"Ah, I missed your candor, Gray."
They sat in peaceful silence for a few minutes, people watching the tourists who passed through the park.
"Will you help me?"
Davidson finally asked. "You're a real bastard for doing it that way," Rory said.
"You hadn't returned a call for half a year. You've been too preoccupied with Lane Phillips and his murder accountability project. So I got creative. I thought you'd appreciate it."
More silence.
"Well?"
Davidson asked again when enough time had passed.
"I'm here, aren't I?"
Rory kept her focus on the fountain. "Tell me about her."
"Camille Bird. 22-year-old gal who was strangled. Body was dumped in the park here."
"When?"
"Last year, January. 21 months,
Davidson said. "And you guys have nothing?"
"I made some threats and banged some pots, but my guys are stumped on this one, Rory."
"I'll need the files on the case," Rory said, still looking at the fountain, but noticing the bend in Davidson's neck as the head of Chicago Homicide looked up subtly and exhaled in relief.
"Thank you," he said.
"Who is Walter Bird?"
"Wealthy businessman and a personal friend of the mayor's, so there's been some urgency on the squad to put this one to rest."
"Because he's rich and connected?" Rory asked. "There should be urgency for any parent whose child is killed." "Where was her body found?" Davidson pointed.
"East side of the park. I'll show you."
Rory stood and allowed Davidson to take the lead as they walked. They made it through the park until they came to a grassy knoll off the walking path. A row of birch trees flanked each side of the area, and Rory's mind calculated the ways someone could transport a body to this location. Davidson walked into the grass.
"Her body was found here."
"Strangled?" Davidson nodded. "Rape?"
"No."
Rory walked to the location where Camille Bird's body had been found and turned in a slow circle, taking in the lakefront and the boats resting on the water. She continued to turn and saw the Chicago skyline. Fat white clouds hovered like overinflated balloons in the otherwise blue sky. She imagined the girl's body found in the dead of winter, bloated and lifeless and frozen through. She imagined the bare trees of January, the foliage stripped by cold. "Dump her here."
"Why?"
she said.
"It's such a risk with no protection from the trees. Whoever did this wanted her to be found. Unless he killed her here. Something got out of control. A heated argument. He kills her and runs."
"That's a lover's quarrel," Rory said.
"And I'm assuming your guys exhausted that angle. Talked to all her boyfriends, current and past? Workmates, old flames?"
Davidson nodded.
"Covered and cleared. All of them."
"Then it wasn't someone she knew. She was killed elsewhere and brought here. Why?"
"My guys don't know."
"I need everything, Ron. Files, autopsy, interviews, everything."
"I can get you all of it, but I've got to put you back on the payroll to do it.
Make it official that you're working again. Then I can get you anything you need.
Rory went silent again as her eyes took in the scene. So many things were firing in her brain. She knew herself well enough not to attempt to tame the influx of information. She wasn't aware of everything she was learning. She knew only to take it all in, and then, in the days and weeks ahead, her brain would sort out the things it was calculating and inventory the images it was capturing. Slowly, Rory would organize it all. She'd study the case file. She'd get to know Camille Bird. She'd put a name and narrative to this poor girl who had been strangled to death. She'd see things the detectives had missed. Rory's uncanny mind would piece together bits of a puzzle everyone else had deemed unsolvable until she had reconstructed the crime in its entirety. Her phone rang, pulling Rory back from the inner workings of her mind. It was her father calling. She thought about letting it go to voicemail, but decided to answer it. "Dad, I'm in the middle of something. Can I call you back?"
"Rory?"
She didn't recognize the voice on the other end of the call, only that it was female and panicked.
"Yes?"
She took a few steps away from Davidson.
"Rory, it's Celia Banner, your father's assistant."
"What's wrong? My dad's number came up on my phone."
"I'm calling from his house. Something's wrong, Rory. He had a heart attack."
"What?"
"We were supposed to meet for breakfast. He never showed." "It's bad, Rory."
"How bad?"
The silence was like a vacuum that sucked the words from Rory's mouth.
"Celia, how bad?"
"He's gone, Rory."
Chapter 4. Chicago, October 14th, 2019. It took a full week after the funeral before Rory found the time and the gumption to enter her father's office. Technically, it was her office as well, but since she hadn't handled a formal case in more than a decade, Rory's involvement in the Moore Law Group was not immediately evident. Her name was on the letterhead, and she drew a 1099 every year for the limited work she did for her father, mostly research and trial prep. But as her role at the Chicago Police Department and Lane's Murder Accountability Project demanded more of her attention over the years, the work she did for the firm became less obvious. Besides Rory's occasional employment, the Moore Law Group was a one-man firm with two employees, a paralegal and an office administrator. With an anorexic staff and a manageable roster of clients, Rory assumed the dissolution of her father's law practice would require a bit of time and expertise, but would ultimately be conquerable in a couple of weeks of concentrated work. Rory's law degree, something she earned more than a decade ago, but had never truly put to use, made her the perfect and only candidate to take care of her father's business affairs. Her mother had passed years before, and Rory had no siblings. Rory entered the building on North Clark Street and rode the elevator to the third floor. She keyed the door and pushed it open. The reception area consisted of a desk in front of tan metal file cabinets straight out of the 70s and was flanked by two offices. The one on the left was her father's. The other belonged to the paralegal. She dropped a week's worth of mail onto the front desk and headed into her father's office. Her first order of business would be to shuffle the active cases to other law firms. Once the firm's docket was cleared, there would be the matter of paying bills and settling payroll for the staff with whatever funds were stashed away. Then Rory could close the lease on the building and shut the place down. Celia, the office administrator and the one who had discovered her father dead in his home, had agreed to meet at noon to go through the files and help with reassignment. Rory settled her purse on the ground, popped open a Diet Coke, and got started. By noon, a mountain of paperwork surrounded her as she sat at her father's desk. She had emptied the file cabinets from the reception area, and the contents were now organized into three stacks: pending, active, and retired. She heard the front door open. Celia, a woman she'd met a handful of times over the years, appeared in the doorway to her father's office. Rory stood.
"Oh, Rory,"
Celia said, rushing past the stacks of files to embrace her in a tight hug. Rory kept her arms straight at her sides and blinked several times behind her thick-rimmed glasses, while the strange woman invaded her personal space in ways most of Rory's acquaintances knew not to.
"I'm so sorry about your father," Celia said into her ear.
Celia had, of course, uttered the same sentence at the funeral a few days before. Rory had been just as stoic in the dimly lit funeral hall, standing next to the coffin that held the wax sculpture of her father. When she felt the warmth of Celia's breath in her ear now, and sensed what she guessed were the woman's tears spilling under her neck, Rory finally put her hands on Celia's shoulders and broke free from her grip. She took a gathering breath and exhaled away the anxiety that was rising from her sternum. "I've been through the file cabinets," Rory finally said. A confused look came over Celia's face as she looked around the office and recognized the amount of work Rory had done. Celia patted the front of her jacket to collect herself, wiped her tears.
"I thought, have you been working on this all week?"
"No, just this morning. I got here a couple of hours ago." Rory had long ago stopped attempting to explain her ability to conquer tasks like this one in a fraction of the time it took others. One reason she never practiced law was because it bored her to death. She remembered classmates spending hours studying textbooks that she memorized in a single skimming, and others taking months-long review courses to prepare for the bar exam, which Rory passed on her first attempt without opening a book to prepare. Another reason she avoided lawyering was because she had a strong aversion to people. The idea of haggling with another attorney over the jail sentence of some two-bit criminal made her skin crawl, and the thought of standing before a judge to plead her case caused her to wheeze with angst. She was better suited working solo to reconstruct crime scenes, her final opinions coming in the form of a written report that ended up on a detective's desk. Rory Moore's world was a walled-off sanctuary she allowed few to enter, and even fewer to understand, which was why this morning's discoveries were particularly disturbing. She learned that her father had several active cases heading to trial in the coming months that would need immediate assistance. Rory had already considered the likelihood that she'd be forced to dust off her diploma, swallow down the bile, and actually make her first appearance in court to explain to a judge that the lead counsel had died and the case would need an extension at best, a mistrial at worst, and that she'd require some guidance from Your Honor to figure out what the hell to do from there.
"A couple of hours?" Celia asked, tugging Rory back from the recesses of her mind. "How is that possible? This looks like every case we've ever taken on."
"It is. Everything I could find in the file cabinets. I wasn't able to check the computers." This was a lie. Rory had no trouble logging on to her father's database. It was password protected, but barely, and Rory had quickly hurdled the minor security precautions to cross-reference the cases in the file cabinets with those on the hard drive. Despite that she had every right to access the computer files, being so far removed from the daily workings of the firm made it feel like trespassing.
"If it's in the cabinet, it's in the computer," Celia said.
"Good. Then this is everything." Rory pointed to the desk and the first stack of folders. "These are pending cases. Should be simple enough to call these clients and explain the situation. The firm won't be taking them on, and they'll have to look elsewhere for representation. I think it would be professional to make a list of other firms that handle these types of cases, so our clients have somewhere to start."
"Of course," Celia said. "Your father would want that."
"The second stack is the retired files. A simple form letter explaining that Frank Moore has died should suffice. I'll leave those two piles for you to handle."
"Not a problem," Celia said. "I'll take care of it. What about those?"
Rory looked at the final hoard of records she had set on her father's desk. The sight started her hyperventilating. She felt the walls of her carefully constructed and meticulously cinder-blocked existence vibrating with unwanted trespassers from beyond. "These are all my dad's open cases. I teased them out into three categories." Rory placed her hand on the first pile. "Currently negotiating plea deals, 12. With her spoken words, she felt her underarms warm with perspiration as she touched the second group of files.
Awaiting court appearances. 16.
A bead of sweat rolled down her spine to dampen the small of her back.
And finally,
she moved her hand to the last pile. Preparing for trial. 3. Her throat caught when she said 3, and she coughed to hide her fear. The 3 cases going to trial would need immediate assistance. A fearful look came over Celia when she saw the blood drain from Rory's face, as if the heart disease that claimed her father surely ran in the family and might strike twice in the same month.
Are you okay?
Rory coughed again and regained her composure.
I'm fine. I'll find a way to deal with the active cases if you could handle the rest.
Celia nodded as she picked up the mound of pending cases. I'll start contacting these clients right away. She carried the stack to her desk in the reception area and went to work. With her father's office door closed, Rory fell into his chair and stared at the files and the 4 empty Diet Cokes that had fueled her morning work. She clicked the computer to life and searched for criminal defense attorneys in Chicago who would be willing to take the cases. Chapter 5. Stateville Correctional Center, October 15, 2019. 4-6 was his alter ego. He had answered to the moniker for so long now that he wasn't sure he would respond any longer to his real name. The nickname originated from the number that had been assigned to him the first night he arrived, stamped onto the back of his jumpsuit in large block font. 12276594-6. Before prison guards knew an inmate's name or the crime for which he had been convicted, they knew his number. His had been shortened to the final 2 digits in the series, 4-6, which had morphed over the years into what most inmates and some uninformed guards believed to be his last name, 4-6. He walked into the prison library and clicked on the lights. It was his home within the walls of the penitentiary. He had run the place for decades. Lifting weights and ballooning his body had never interested him, and joining the animals in the prison yard to colonize into sects of gangs was equally unappealing. Instead, he found the library, befriended the elderly lifer who ran the place, and bided his time. The lifer started wheezing during the winter of 1989 and never saw the last decade of the 20th century. A guard rapped on the bars of 4-6 cell the next morning to tell him the old man was gone, paroled to the heavens. The library was 4-6 to run. Don't screw it up. He wouldn't. For 30 years, the library had been under his control. In total, he had logged 4 decades on the inside without a single incident. The stellar track record had turned him nearly invisible, like the superheroes he read about in comic books he managed to score every month. He despised comics and graphic novels, but made sure to read them just the same. They gave him a softer persona and helped hide the longings that still loomed in his soul. Prior to jail, he had set his life around the rush, a feeling that washed over him after he spent time with his victims. The rush had controlled his mind and shaped his existence. It was something from which he could never escape. After he was caught, though, he had no choice but to conform to life in prison. Withdrawal had been agonizing. He longed so badly for the feeling of power and dominance the rush had once provided, for the incongruous sense of righteousness he enjoyed when he slipped the nylon noose around his neck and offered himself up to the lure of euphoria that only his victims could provide. But after the dizzying withdrawal had subsided and he settled into the years in front of him, he looked to something else to fill the void. It quickly became obvious what it would be. The secret that had destroyed his life lay buried somewhere outside the walls of this prison, and he decided to spend the final chapter of his life unearthing it. He sat at his desk in the front of the library. Only in America could a man who murdered so many be given such freedom. a desk and an entire prison library over which to rule. But after so many decades in this place, only a scant few on the inside knew his story. Even fewer cared. His anonymity was another reason he never corrected anyone who called him 4-6. It added to his cover. The world had turned the lights out on him years ago. Only recently had the halogen of the past started to flicker back to life. Alone in his library, he unfolded the Chicago Tribune and found the headline on page 2. 40 years after the summer of 1979, the thief set to walk free. His gaze passed over his old nickname, the thief. He couldn't ignore what the title did to him, the subtle stream of adrenaline it provided. But he was also aware of the downside to such a perfect signature. It was sure to draw attention and stir up memories. As headlines started popping up and talking heads began discussing the summer of 79, he would need to find a way to avoid the protesters and escape those who planned to haunt and torture him. He needed just a small window of anonymity after his release to complete his final journey, the planning of which he had dedicated his life in prison. It was a voyage he'd waited decades to embark upon, and had foolishly believed others could accomplish for him. But the thief was the only one who could unearth the thing that haunted him, the secret that had ruined him. This many years after his reign of terror, his victims were faceless and anonymous. Even when he visited the darkest parts of his mind and tried to conjure some of the rush that used to fuel him, he could only scantly remember any of the women. They were all dead and gone, erased from his memory by time and indifference. Only one remained vibrant in his memory, clear and present as if 40 years were merely a blink of the eye, a single beat of his heart. She was the lone standout he could never forget. She ran through his thoughts during the quiet days in the library and haunted his dreams when he slept. She was the only one he remembered, and his looming freedom presented a long overdue opportunity to sew up loose ends with her. Chicago, August 1979. Angela Mitchell stared at the television. She stood with her friend Catherine Blackwell and watched the news report. On the screen, a reporter stood in front of a darkened alley as the sun set on the summer night. Trash cans rested against chain-link fences, and weeds pushed through the cracks of the uneven pavement. "Another woman," the reporter said, "has been confirmed missing. Samantha Rogers, a 22-year-old from Lincoln Park, was reported missing on Tuesday after she failed to show up for work. Authorities believe she is the fifth victim in a string of unexplained disappearances that started in the first week of May." The reporter walked along the boulevard. A few pedestrians passed behind her and stared into the camera with stupid grins, unaware of the tragedy being reported. "The disappearances started May 2nd with the abduction of Clarissa Manning. Since then, three other women have gone missing from the streets of Chicago. None have been found, and it is suspected that their disappearances are all related. Now, Samantha Rogers is feared to be the latest victim of a predator the authorities are calling the thief. The Chicago Police Department continues to warn young women not to walk the streets alone. The authorities are asking for any leads in the whereabouts of the missing women and have set up a tip line."
"Five women in 3 months," Catherine said. "How have the police not been able to find this guy?"
"They have to know something," Angela said in a quiet and reserved voice. "They're probably keeping the details away from the public so as not to tip this guy off to what they know."
Angela's husband walked into the room and clicked off the television. He kissed her lightly on the forehead.
"Come on. Dinner's ready."
"It's just terrible," Angela said.
Angela's husband ran his hand over her shoulder and pulled her close for a quick hug. He cocked his head toward the kitchen, making eye contact with Catherine as he left the room. Angela continued to stare at the blank television screen. The reporter's profile was burned into her mind,
An afterimage that allowed Angela to recall every detail of the woman's face, the alley, the green street signs in the background, and even the dumb looks on the faces of the passers-by who had walked through the frame. It was a gift and a curse to remember everything she saw. She finally blinked the reporter's image away, allowing it to fade from her visual cortex, just as Catherine tugged lightly at Angela's elbow, pulling her toward the dinner table. Chicago, August 1979. Four of them, Angela and Catherine, along with their husbands, sat around the dinner table. Thomas, Angela's husband, had finished grilling chicken and vegetables, and they settled for the air-conditioned safety of their dining room rather than the original plan of eating on the back patio. The summer heat was stifling, the humidity thick, and the mosquitoes unrelenting.
"Sorry to spend another summer night inside," Thomas said. "We wait all year for winter to leave and still find ourselves stuck inside."
"I've been spending all my days outside lately,"
Bill Blackwell, Catherine's husband, said.
"One of our foremen quit a couple of weeks ago. I've been running his crews, so a break from the heat is fine with me."
"We haven't hired anyone to replace him yet?" Thomas asked.
Thomas and Bill were partners in their concrete business, pouring foundations for new homes, paving industrial parking lots and indoor garages. Their business, started when they were both 20 years old, had grown to a mid-sized company with a unionized labor force.
"I've got a request in to Local 255. They're working on it. But until we hire someone, I'm running the crews, which means I'm outside all day. And with temperatures in the mid-90s, I'm very happy to be sitting inside tonight."
"If it helps," Thomas said. "I had to work the bobcat when one of our guys was sick this week."
"That doesn't help," Bill said. "Driving a cat is not the same as running the crews. If I get any more mosquito bites, I'll contract malaria."
"Should we be more sympathetic toward our hard-working men, Angela?" Catherine asked.
Angela stared at her plate, a detached look on her face.
"Angela," Thomas said.
When she didn't respond, he reached out and touched her shoulder, startling her. Angela looked up suddenly. The expression on her face made it seem like she was surprised to see others in the room.
"Bill was just saying how bad the mosquitoes are," Thomas said in an encouraging voice, "and that he's working harder than I am down at the shop. I need my wife to defend me here."
Angela tried to smile, but ended up simply nodding at Thomas.
"Anyway," Catherine said, pointing at her husband's neck, "if you get any more bug bites, you'll not have to worry about malaria as much as needing a blood transfusion. It looks like Dracula got to you."
Bill put his hand to his neck.
"I had an allergic reaction to the bug spray," he said.
Thomas kept his hand on Angela's shoulder, an attempt to coax her into the conversation. She put her hand on top of his and offered another false smile.
"I'm not sure insect repellent works on vampires," Angela said.
This brought chuckles from the group. Angela tried to engage in the dinner conversation, but all she could see was the afterimage of the television reporter still burned in her mind, and all she could concentrate on were the women who had gone missing this summer.
Chicago, August 1979.
When their guests were gone, Angela cinched the top of the garbage bag and tied it off. Her husband wiped his brow with his forearm as he stood in front of the sink and cleaned dishes. Entertaining was a new experience for her, and something to which Angela was still adapting. Before meeting Thomas, she had never enjoyed the experience of close friends, or any friends at all, for that matter. She had spent her life on the outskirts of societal norms. Vivid memories from Angela's youth reminded her why traditional friendships were impossible. When Angela was age 5, a girl had approached her in the kindergarten classroom to offer a Betsy McCall doll and the invitation to play together. To this day, Angela could feel the overwhelming sense of discomfort from someone standing so close to her, and the revulsion that came at the thought of touching a doll so many other children had handled. Even before kindergarten, Angela had taken to carrying her possessions in plastic sandwich bags to keep them safe from germs and filth. Her parents had learned that Angela's tantrums, complete sensory detachments, were quelled only when her belongings were safe inside the plastic bags. The habit continued through grade school and kept her sealed off from friendships as tightly as her possessions were protected from the world. So, hosting Catherine and Bill Blackwell for dinner had taken Angela as far out of her comfort zone as she'd been in months. But it was a good thing. It was making her life more normal. She had Thomas to thank for her transformation. Angela would forever be aware of the sideways glances she encountered from most of the world, but she took solace in the fact that Thomas accepted her, despite her many idiosyncrasies. Through her marriage, a new world had opened up. Catherine was the first person she called a friend. Around others, Angela managed to control many of the unique habits that plagued the rest of her time,